ruler of this island, the son of Maharaj Priyavrata, named Dityaputra, had two sons named Ramanaka and Dattaki. He granted the two sides of the island to these two sons, and then personally engaged himself in activities for the sake of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, like his elder brother, Medhatiti. For the fulfillment of material desires, the inhabitants of this tract of land worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead as represented by Lord Brahma. They offer prayers to the Lord as follows. Lord Brahma is known as Karma Maya, the form of ritualistic ceremonies, because by performing ritualistic ceremonies, one may attain his position, and because the Vedic ritualistic hymns become manifest from him. He is devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead without deviation, and therefore, in one sense, he is not different from the Lord. Nevertheless, he should be worshipped, not as the monists worship him, but in duality. One should always remain a servitor of the Supreme Lord, the supreme worshipable deity. We therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto Lord Brahma, the form of manifest Vedic knowledge. Purport. In this verse, the word karmamayam, attainable by the Vedic ritualistic system, is significant. The Vedas say, Swadharmanishta shata janmabi puman varinchitam eti. One who strictly follows the principles of Varnashram Dharma for at least 100 births will be rewarded with the post of Lord Brahma. It is also significant that although Lord Brahma is extremely powerful, he never thinks himself one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He always knows that he is an eternal servant of the Lord, because the Lord and the servant are identical on the spiritual platform. Brahma is herein addressed as Bhagavan. Bhagavan is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. But if a devotee serves him with full faith, the meaning of the Vedic literature is revealed to him. Therefore, Brahma is called Brahma Linga, which indicates that his entire form consists of Vedic knowledge. Om Agana Timirandasya Gananjana Chalakaya Chakshun Militangena Tazamai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasavi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We're learning many inconceivable things about the universe in the Bhagavatam. And we are in no position, of course, to argue about it. We are in no position to judge what is what is what. The fifth canto is very humbling in that we clearly see the limitations of knowledge based on the senses. Sometimes the question is asked, the Bhagavatam and its presentation, generally, is it allegory? As modern scholars like to say, myth, but instructive myth. In other words, things have gone a step up in their eyes from just dismissing the Vedas as myth. Now, it is acknowledged that myth has constructive value in that it imparts lessons for human beings. So it's not that myth is a bad thing. In that way, we're supposed to be pacified as devotees of the Lord and as followers of Srimad Bhagavatam. We should be pacified and rest in peace, knowing that the Bhagavatam is instructive myth. Srila Prabhupada was asked the question once, is the Bhagavatam mainly allegory, allegorical stories? For example, Paranjana. There it's clearly said in the fourth canto, this is an allegory. But what about the rest of the Bhagavatam? And the question was put forth to Srila Prabhupada. He answered that, no, generally the Bhagavatam is literal. Even some devotees will quake at that statement. Oh, it's all literal. Oh my goodness, what are we going to do? How will intelligent people ever be impressed by our saying this is literal? Humility is required. Srila Prabhupada went on to explain that generally it's literal, and what is allegory, a minor portion, you have to be a liberated soul to understand. Now, is that just some kind of Hindu taboo from ancient India? That unless you're on a certain level, you can't really understand these ancient texts. No, it is quite practical. Bhagavatam requires, as stated in the very beginning, a heightened level of consciousness in order to for someone to enter into Bhagavatam. Paramo namatsaranam satam. The Bhagavatam is meant for paramahansas who are completely free from envy. So we look at ourselves and say, well, I'm not so envious. I don't mind if anyone around me has their share as long as I'm getting mine. That's the modern definition of non-envious. As long as you're getting yours, then I don't... and while I'm getting mine, then it's okay. But as soon as I don't get mine, then we really need to take a look at what you're getting. We need to do some accounting. Just look at the current situation, economic situation in the USA. You'll probably see that Americans become very strange creatures when things are lacking and they're not getting. As long as consumerism is raging, then people are prepared to be charitable and consider the well-being of others. But as soon as you're not getting what you think is your quota, then you become you retaliate, you become angry, you become intolerant. In fact, some major social thinkers advocate that economic growth, what we call the mode of passion, it's work, 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 buy, 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 achieve, achieve, achieve. This is necessary for the development of fine moral qualities. Because when people have money, they're more inclined to be charitable and caring. This is Dharma according to Kali Yuga. Feverish economic development is necessary so that people's good character will come out. In times of economic prosperity, people are more into brotherhood and humanitarian activities and caring for the environment, this or that. But when the economy goes down, it's dog eat dog. Therefore, what is the solution? Not Krishna consciousness. What the solution is, let the mode of passion, economic growth go on, and then people will be nice, as you've seen. This is not real human civilization. When we look at Bhagavatam, we should understand that we are seeing a standard that is normal. Often we have a jaded vision that Bhagavatam is abnormal and we are normal. So here we are, normal people, looking at a very abnormal shastra. But the more you immerse yourself in Srimad Bhagavatam, the more you understand that the readers are abnormal and the Bhagavatam is normal. And the more you read, the more you start to realize you're becoming normal by reading Bhagavatam, because Bhagavatam is normal. And then what you considered to be normal before is actually a a great distortion. It'll take some time for devotees, both in the West and in India, to truly understand the havoc caused by a godless society. I was recently with Yadavar Prabhu in Canada, and he was telling me how once in Calcutta, Prabhupada very solemnly addressed devotees in this room, "You just don't know how bad your world leaders are. You really don't know. You really haven't grasped how bad they are." Of course, we'll say, "Oh, they look like, there are some rogues and cheaters, but they're nice guys. They try to do their best. Nice ladies. What can be done in the current situation?" But to actually think, we don't know how bad they are. It means we need to understand what is the true standard of human civilization. What is the true standard of leadership? And without Bhagavatam, how will anyone ever know? Bhagavatam is the gold standard. It actually gives you a measuring stick how to judge what is what. We're hearing about Lord Brahma, the most intelligent person in the universe, Adi Kavi. His body is made of Vedic knowledge, Brahmalinga, he's called, which indicates that his entire form consists of Vedic knowledge. He's also known as Karmamaya, the form of ritualistic ceremonies, because by performing ritualistic ceremonies, one may attain his position, and because the Vedic ritualistic hymns become manifest from him. We find out in the purport, the Vedas state, if you strictly follow the principles of Vanarsham Dharma for at least 100 births, you can be rewarded with the post of Lord Brahma. We have no idea what it means to strictly follow Vanarsham Dharma, even for 1 hour. But to speak of 100 births, well, the position of Lord Brahma is given to the most pious person in the universe. Sometimes, on rare occasions, Vishastra says, when there is no human being, or no living entity, qualified to take the post of Lord Brahma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead assumes the post. Yet as powerful as Lord Brahma is, he's nothing compared to the power possessed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We saw that in the Brahma Vimohana Leela, the bewilderment of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma wasn't thinking he was doing any major disturbance, just a little tinkering in Krishna's Leela. Just a removal of the cowherd boys and the calves. And because the issue in Brahma's mind was not that he was anti-Krishna, not that he was against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The issue was, can that little boy in Vrindavan, the little blue boy playing with cowherd boys and calves, can he really be my worshipable Lord? So what you see in Lord Brahma, at the beginning of this Brahma Vimohana Leela, is the attitude of a research scientist as known today. Let me, with my own senses, with my own analyses, let me see what's going on here. So as you know, he removed the cowherd boys and calves. But he's Brahma. He's not any ordinary living entity. He's the most intelligent living entity in the universe. A split second later, he changed his mind. Wait a minute. This could be going too far. A split second later. Perhaps you can remember starting to do something and then immediately changing your mind just a second later. No, I don't think I'll do that. Maybe you're at a very wonderful feast of Krishna Prasad and you decide one more gulab jamun, one more piece of pizza. And then, no, I have to get up tomorrow morning. And you even pick it up. Has it happened? You picked up the prasad and then you, no. That's okay. So that's as quickly as Brahma changed his mind. But in terms of earth time, that was 1 year. After a split second of Brahma's time, he returned. And he couldn't at all understand what's going on. He saw calves and cowherd boys playing with Krishna just as before. So then he had to do a Brahma calculation, in which even he, as Brahma Linga, whose entire form consists of Vedic knowledge, he became totally bewildered. He began to consider, which are the real calves and cowherd boys? I've put some asleep in the cave by my mystic potency, but then I look here in the pastures and they're more. They're exact same cowherd boys and calves. So which is real and which isn't real? He went through so many calculations. The Acharya's comment that actually one of the calculations he went through was, well, maybe they both are false and the real ones are in another universe. He was really getting cosmological. Or maybe when I look in the cave, they're there, they're truly there, and before my vision totally turns to the pasture grounds, Krishna takes them from the cave and gets them in the pasture before I can turn my head and see them in the pasture. And remember, Brahma has four heads. So he can look in different directions at once, but he's willing to give Krishna credit that maybe Krishna can move them so fast that they're in the pasture before I can turn my heads there. And then when I turn my heads back to the cave, Krishna moves them so fast that before my glance reaches the cave, Krishna's put them back in the cave. So he was going on and on like this, trying to understand which group of cowherd boys and cows is real, which is false. Maybe they're both real. His circuits were being totally overloaded. But Krishna didn't let the bewilderment of Lord Brahma stay on that level. Krishna escalated. He upped the ante. While Brahma is totally bewildered, trying to understand what is what, he sees the cowherd boys and calves turn into four-handed Vishnu forms. And then he sees these four-handed Vishnu forms worshipped by all moving and non-moving entities, including himself, including Brahma. We cannot understand the degree of confusion, the degree of how literally Brahma's intelligence short-circuited. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation in which trying to think about it just causes a meltdown in your brain. You'll actually start seeing that, most likely, in the USA, as people try to figure out, how do you get the economy going again, even though we don't manufacture anything anymore in the USA? We don't farm. We don't manufacture. Yet we're going to get the economy going. How are we going to do it? A hint was given a few weeks ago. It was announced in the mainstream media. Guess what? Afghanistan has $1 trillion worth of minerals. That's why our soldiers are there. Understand? $1 trillion worth of minerals. Maybe that'll save us. There's no way that human intelligence can cope with such a situation, but let's pretend, and someone will make money while we're pretending we can cope with the situation. That is motive passion. Just pretend, just bluff, and someone is lining their pockets while the bluffing is going on. So even these tiny mundane affairs, people, their intelligence short circuits. Just think, Brahma, the most intelligent person in the universe, his intelligence melted down. Seeing the cows and cowherd boys and calves, whom he couldn't understand which group is real, now he's seeing the cowherd boys and calves turn into four-handed Vishnu forms, worship even by him. Finally, his bewilderment became so intense, the meltdown of his intelligence, that out of mercy, Krishna just covered the whole scene over. As this Brahma's, he basically collapsed with bewilderment. He practically went unconscious with bewilderment. So Krishna just let him off the hook. He just covered the whole situation. It's like the lights went out in Brahma. Krishna just let his lights go out rather than have Brahma continue to just experience a meltdown trying to figure out what was happening. So when Brahma came to, so to speak, he saw just Krishna and the cowherd boys and calves like nothing ever happened. But Brahma had got the point. He realized his own intelligence was just a piece of dust compared to Krishna's intelligence. He realized he shouldn't have tried to compete with Krishna's mystic power, which had bewildered even Balaram. Krishna's yoga maya had even covered Lord Balaram. So Brahma understood. What is the use of me? And I've made an offense. So therefore, he approached Krishna and fell at his feet like a golden rod. And he was making obeisances again and again, making dandavats at Krishna's lotus feet. Because remember, Brahma has four heads, so he had to arrange that each head would get to touch the feet. And while each head was being positioned to touch the lotus feet of Krishna, he was bathing the Lord's lotus feet with his tears. But meanwhile, try to understand the mercy that Brahma received. Krishna let him see Vrindavan as it is. After Brahma had a complete meltdown and Krishna withdrew the vision of the cowherd boys and calves as four-handed Vishnu forms. In other words, Brahma was seeing the opulence of Vaikuntha, but Krishna mercifully wanted him to see even more opulence. The opulence of Goloka Vrindavan is far superior than even the opulence of Vaikuntha. So Brahma got to see that. He got to see Vrindavan as it is, where all the living entities live in perfect cooperation. Everyone and everything is a servant of Krishna. Even the water, the air, the days, the nights, they're all devotees serving Krishna. Brahma got to see that. He had the understanding that the opulence of Vaikuntha, presided over by the four-handed Vishnu forms, can't even compare to the opulence of Vrindavan. After Rath Yatra, you know, there's the Hara Panchami festival. in which the Lakshmi Devi is wondering, where has Lord Jagannath gone? He's gone to Vrindavan, he's gone to Gundicha, and he said he was coming back the next day. He hasn't returned yet. What's happening? So Lakshmi Devi and her assistants actually go to apprehend the servitors of Lord Jagannath. And they put forward a very crucial and penetrating question to the servitors of Lord Jagannath. We know your master is so expert. How then could he leave the opulences of Dwarka just for the flower gardens of Srimati Radharani? He's expert. How could he make such a mistake? So you know how these servitors of Lord Jagannath were arrested and so humiliated that they fell unconscious on the ground. They were bound up. They were subject to abusive words. And they actually were unconscious due to humiliation. And they promised they would bring Lord Jagannath back to the opulence of Dwarka. Puri is Dwarka. And rectify the situation. So Lord Chaitanya and his associates, they're watching this Harapanchami festival. And they're trying to cover their faces because they're laughing. They've never seen such egotistical pride. They question one another. Have you ever seen any pride like this? As shown by the servitors of Lakshmi Devi, how they're so acting so arrogantly? And then Srup Damodar begins to explain about the pride in Vrindavan amongst Krishna's consorts, how they have different types of egotistical pride in their dealings. Srivas Thakur, he objects. What is all this talk about Vrindavan? Let me tell you about the opulences of Vaikuntha. But who is Srivas Thakur? He's Narada Muni. Srivas Thakur became overwhelmed by Narada Svabhav, his nature is Narada Muni. So he therefore began to defend the opulences of Vaikuntha. What's so important in Vrindavan? Some forest minerals, some peacock feathers, boiled milk. But look at the opulences of Vaikuntha. My Lakshmi Devi sits on a throne made of brilliant jewels. Srup Damodar replied to the challenge. He defended the opulences of Vrindavan. He explained that everywhere in Vrindavan, the water is like nectar. The land is made of chintamani, touchstone. And every step is a dance. Every word is a song. And Srup Damodar gave the conclusion. The opulences of Vaikuntha are just like a drop compared to the opulences of Vrindavan. So what was Srivas Thakur's response? He began to dance wildly like a madman, making funny sounds while slapping his armpits. This is the result of ecstatic sangha between such foremost devotees. Even when they're arguing, even when they're trying to go one up on one another, it's all for the pleasure of Krishna. And Lord Chaitanya pointed out, Srivas Thakur, will you get off of Srup Damodar's case? You are a devotee of Vaikuntha. He's a simple devotee of Vrindavan. Just back off, back off. After this challenge and counter-challenge was over, what came next? A huge kirtan. That's always a result with Lord Chaitanya and his associates. There's always a huge kirtan. And Lord Chaitanya's ecstasy was doubling and redoubling. constantly. The devotees are becoming exhausted, but Lord Caitanya's dancing, his kirtan energy, kept increasing at every moment. And suddenly, Lord Nityananda saw a very confidential thing. He saw in the midst of this most ecstatic kirtan, after the debate about the opulences of Vaikuntha versus the opulences of Vrindavan, he saw Lord Caitanya appear in the form of Srimati Radharani. Lord Nityananda taught us a lesson that we should be very careful about Srimati Radharani in terms of our discussions, in terms of our presentations. Lord Nityananda offered very carefully, offered his obeisances from a distance, seeing Lord Caitanya in that most confidential form of Srimati Radharani. So in this way, bewilderment is a normal feature of the spiritual world. Bewilderment of Lord Brahma, even Srivas Thakur, challenge the opulence of Vrindavan. We'll never get to the platform of understanding these intimate affairs of the spiritual world unless we can make our peace with Bhagavatam as we see it in front of us. Our main problem is thinking we are the enjoyer. That's our main point of self-reference in our existence. I am the enjoyer. Okay. Everything else can be understood based on that premise. But the Bhagavatam is telling us everything else will be misunderstood based on that premise. So then we fight back. Well, what's wrong with being the enjoyer? Maybe in a subdued way, wouldn't it be all right? The total renovative work of the Bhagavatam is to totally cleanse our misconception that we are the enjoyer. And this is what may seem to make bhakti, make Krishna consciousness heavy, as they say, or a little maybe intimidating. We have to be honest about the discomfort, the source of the discomfort that we're feeling. It's that our identity, our misidentity as being the enjoyer is being attacked. And we get very defensive about that. This is the kind of tightness around the collar that we sometimes feel as we go about our devotional activities. It's like something wants to reassert itself. Like, what about me? What am I getting from me? What is this doing for me? We can go on for a while with some sacrifice. But, you know, in material existence, when you sacrifice for something, you know what's coming ahead, right? It'll be your time. It'll be your enjoyment. So in material existence, sacrifice is always followed by selfishness, bhoga tyaga. First, the renunciation, I'll do this for my job, I'll do this for my family. Then, after a while, you know the inevitable has to happen. Okay, it's my time. This tendency creeps into our devotional service that I've given so much to Krishna, what about me? In those moments, we need to consider it's a very healthy and wonderful thing to have our misidentity as enjoyer challenged. And gradually, we begin to thank Krishna for that. Thank you for keeping up the pressure on my misconceptions. That's actually love. That you're giving me circumstances, giving me association to understand, to motivate me to understand and see that I'm not the enjoyer. Instead of resenting it, we begin to thank Krishna for it. And when that happens, our bhakti really starts to escalate. Once we make our peace with Krishna and his constant program to get his devotees to see they're not the enjoyer. Once we make our peace with Krishna in that department, then our spiritual life can really start to roll. Up until that point, it's a bit of a struggle. Okay, Krishna, yes, I know, you mean the best for me. At the same time, wouldn't it be better if I would just be allowed to enjoy? And then my service would be more enthusiastic, and we're always going back and forth like that. There is enjoyment in bhakti, but it's all indirect enjoyment. We enjoy Krishna's enjoyment. This is the greatest mystery of life. How can we be satisfied enjoying Krishna's enjoyment? But once we become comfortable with this principle, and once we get some realization about this, we actually finally become peaceful and our heart knows true satisfaction.